Now I have set before you these two things, life and blessing, death and curses. Therefore, choose life. That was my final word. I said, therefore, choose life. And that's what I would say to Mishima-san. You should have chosen life.
Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. My guest today is Paul McCarthy. He holds a PhD in East Asian languages and civilizations from Harvard, and has taught Japanese, Anglo-American, and comparative literature at universities in the US and Japan, as well as translating many works of Japanese literature. Most recently, Paul translated the title story in a new anthology of short fiction by Japanese writer Mishima Yukio.
Shall I show it?
Yes, we've got a copy here. Voices of the Fallen Heroes and Other Stories, published this year.
This is the American edition, and this is the British edition.
Okay. I like the British cover, actually.
Me too. This is Penguin, yeah. And this is Vintage.
Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show and for welcoming me into your home.
My pleasure.
Now, today we're talking about Mishima Yukio, who is perhaps the most iconic Japanese author of the modern era, perhaps.
I would say three, Tanizaki, Kawabata, and Mishima.
Yeah, well, three. And of course, Tanizaki, you've also...
my dissertation.
Your dissertation.
Right? So mostly I've done Tanizaki.
You study that. And then Kawabata and Mishima also have this relationship where, I live in Kamakura and Kawabata lived out there. In a sense, perhaps you could expand on this, but my impression was there was a mentorship role or a sort of a sensei kind of a role that Kawabata had.
Definitely,
with Mishima.
Definitely. Mishima had other people play the roles of mentor when he was in junior high school and high school, but then in college, we went to Todai, and right after the war, I would say Kawabata Yasunari was his mentor and his introducer to the bundan, to the literary circles.
It's fascinating. And just as an aside, living in Kamakura and sort of feeling that literary energy that you get with people like Kawabata, having spent a lot of time there, the different associations and even cafes that they used to hang out in Kamakura and in the southern coast there. I feel an energy there that's quite profound, actually. It's quite hard to describe.
It's a great place to live. I mean, I've always lived in Tokyo, but my personal sort of mentor here in Japan, academic person who was very kind to me, was Nakamura Mitsuo. He was a Japanese literary critic and also a specialist in French literature.
I see.
And he taught at Meiji. And he lived in Ogigayatsu in Kamakura. So I would often, when I was here in the 70s, I would often go, living in Tokyo, but I would go to Kamakura and then go to Ogigayatsu and have long, delicious suppers with him and his wife and talk about things.
That's fascinating. So I guess coming back to Mishima, though, it seems appropriate that we start not from the beginning, but from the end. In 1970, Mishima took his own life by sword in a very spectacular fashion upon the balcony of the Ministry of Defense. Not far from here, actually.
Ichigaya. It's not far from here at all.
Just up the road. Some would call it a coup d'etat attempt. Others would call it a poetic coda to a prolific career that had been focused on these great questions of beauty and death. And I thought perhaps maybe we could start with an introduction to Mishima and perhaps how you would introduce Mishima for an audience who may not know his work.
He began to write in the late 1940s and was very active in the 50s and 60s until his death in late 1970. And he was extremely, precocious, since he was already writing major novels in his early 20s. The first novel is not so well known and has never been translated into English, but the second novel was Kamen no Kokuhaku, Confessions of a Mask, and that sold a lot, had very good reviews in Japan. And about 10 years later, it was translated into English and published by New Directions, which was a rather bold publisher in the U.S. The problem with Confessions of a Basque in the U.S. in the 1950s was that, in some sense, it was a homosexual novel. Homosexual novel with no sexual activity at all, except masturbation. It centers on homosexual fantasy and the way a young man is torn between homosexual and heterosexual inclinations or social expectations. That was not a problem at all in Japan. No one sort of regarded it as scandalous that he wrote a novel on that subject. But in the United States, it was another matter. His original publisher in the U.S. was Knopf, a very, very good, very prestigious publisher. And Alfred Knopf apparently read it and said, he's a very, very talented writer, we want him, but we're not going to start him. We're not going to have him make his debut with this gay novel. We wouldn't say gay in those days, this homosexual novel. So that was why there was a 10-year lapse. I don't think it was published 1948 or 49 in Japan and 1958 or 59 in the U.S. So that was sort of his debut, but not in the U.S. It came about 10 years later. He also wrote a second major novel that dealt with homosexual sort of subculture in Tokyo. It didn't focus so much on fantasy, protagonist's homosexuality. It was about a misanthropic old man who hated women, and perhaps felt that he had been wronged by them. At any rate, he was not only misanthropic, but misogynist old man. And he devised a plan to find a very handsome young man who would appeal to a variety of women and become their lover and then leave them in the lurch. And he could do this because he was himself gay, as we would now say. So he was very handsome, very attracted to women, and supported by this old man, he essentially made women fall in love with him and then jilted them. So there's a lot of description of cafes and bars and sort of places where we would now say gay people gathered. But that was early 1950s. Now, that was also translated about 10 years later, because, again, the American publishing was not very receptive to that. But that was published as, the Japanese title was Kinjiki, Forbidden Colors, in English. So those two, Confessions of a Mask and Forbidden Colors, one homosexual fantasies, the other homosexual subculture, but also the theme of misogyny and using sex as a kind of weapon against the opposite sex, in this case. Then he sort of changed tack, and he wrote, for example, it's called in Japanese Shiosai, The Sound of Waves, and he says it was inspired by the Greek legend of Daphnis and Chloe, a lyrical love story, about two innocent, a man and a woman, young man and young woman, who fall in love. And there are ups and downs, of course, in the relationship, but it has a happy ending. It's a beautiful story. It was very popular in Japan. It was made into movies two or three times, sold tremendously well. And Knopf was certainly ready to publish that. That was translated and published. And that, I think, was probably his debut novel in the West. Then he went on and did all kinds of things. He did Utage no Ato, After the Banquet, which is kind of a political novel. It's how politics in Japan is financed and how personal relationships are important and how scandals are hidden. That was also successful. It was quickly translated into English. It did make a problem for him because he was accused of the invasion of privacy, the suggestion that one of the characters was too close to an actual politician, and everybody could guess who it was. So I think he was taken to court. I don't remember the outcome of it, whether he had to pay a fine or something, or pay damages to... At any rate, he was challenged on that legally because of, not obscenity, but or anything like that, but invasion of privacy. And then he did a memorable novel. It's probably the longest translated title and the boldest translated title that I can think of. The title in Japanese is Gogo no Eiko, which means an afternoon's towing. Towing in the afternoon. And John Nathan hated the title and convinced Mishima-san that it needed something very different.
The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea.
The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea. And John thought of several titles and read them out, and apparently Mishima said, let's go with that one, yeah. The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea, which sort of is the theme of the story already embodied in that very, very long title. That was made into a film in the United States with Kris Kristofferson. And so he had that. Also in the 50s, he wrote a really splendid novel, one of his best works, King Kakuji. Mm. Temple of the Golden Pavilion.
So Mishima had this string of work, quite eclectic perhaps, that has become more and more focused, though, as we go through the 60s, into a theme of death, it seems. And I wonder maybe we could talk a little bit about how that seemed to come through, I think, in his later work a lot more than maybe the earlier work.
Yeah, for example, the theme, there's a lot of focus on kind of death fantasies, even in Confessions of a Mask, a very early novel. The young men he looks at and fantasizes about oftentimes end dead, ritually murdered or something like that, or dismembered, with more blood. Not so much death, but destruction is the focus of Temple of the Golden Pavilion. That's it was a national treasure, Kokoho, and based on a real incident, a novice monk was somehow obsessed with the Golden Pavilion. He goes through various stages. He imagines what it's like, and then he sees it, and he's disappointed because it's a little bit old and dingy, having been there for 400 or 500 years. That he becomes aware of it, of its spiritual beauty and its importance. And he's obsessed and oppressed by it, but there is a saving grace. This also appears often in Mishima. Since it's during World War II, the novice monk assumes that at some point Kyoto will be subject to aerial bombardment, which thank God didn't happen, but could have, but didn't happen. And the Temple of the Golden Pavilion, and he himself will be destroyed. So this Mishima-san, we know from his autobiographical writings, he thought that he would not live beyond 20, which would have been 1945, just precisely the end of the war. He, like other young men of his generation, assumed he would probably be drafted and die fighting, or if not, then be incinerated in incendiary bomb attacks. So that theme of, but the odd thing in the Temple of the Golden Pavilion is that it's a kind of consolation for Mizoguchi, who's the name of the principal character, that somehow he and the temple will both be destroyed and somehow therefore linked together, and feels a sense of oneness. But the war ends and Kyoto is not attacked, and the Golden Pavilion remains, and it becomes a tourist site. And there's some rather painful accounts of an American soldier who brings his Japanese girlfriend, probably one of the girls who serviced American soldiers at that time, and she's pregnant, and it's really pretty shocking even now to talk about it, but the American essentially bribes the novice monk to trample on the woman's stomach, and this leads to a miscarriage. And so that's problem solved as far as the American is concerned. But of course, it leaves a terrible sort of sense of guilt in Mizoguchi.
That's fascinating. This question of oneness, again, this question of death, of beauty, of all of these things, it seems to permeate through Mishima's work. Yeah. And again, this period of time when he was a young man during the war, growing up in Imperial Japan, seeing these visions, this the high point of the propaganda of the empire, telling him about the divinity of the emperor, talking about the Japanese spirit, the warrior spirit, all these things that were pushed on people, and then to have that taken away in a moment with the ending of the war.
Yeah.
And in particular, something I wanted to talk about was when it comes to the emperor, a theme that comes up quite a lot in Voices, or a key theme in Voices of the Fallen Heroes, and also in some of his other work, the divinity of the emperor and this kind of god in human form.
Right. That's exactly right. Allah still called me god in human form.
And it's...
Or a god in human form, let's say, yes, a god.
It's fascinating because, you know, diving into this, it simply finished one day, and it was January 1st, 1946, where the newspapers ran the declaration that the Humanity Declaration, I believe it was called, where basically he said, like, it was a false consciousness. That wasn't true. I wasn't a god. And that sort of, what must there have been like to have that world system just turned off, that whole worldview turned off, and to be faced with this material reality of a country that had lost the war.
Yes.
Maybe you could tell me a bit more about your thoughts.
Well, that's precisely what Mishima is dealing with in Voices of the Fallen Heroes. Let me just go back for a second, just to finish it up, and say that ultimately the novice monk decides that he must destroy the Temple of the Golden Pavilion. Mm. He will set fire to it, and he will die along with it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the last minute, he breaks out, and the temple does burn down, or the pavilion burns down, but he retreats to a hill, and he says he took out a cigarette and lit it and felt that he had sort of completed a day's work.
Yes.
That's the ending. Yeah.
Well, and just to add on to that as well, I mean, the other thing we must look at, and I think this will link back throughout the conversation, but Mishima himself, despite these themes of honorable death, of war, of sacrifice, he, of course, didn't fight in the war, even though he was called up to be drafted.
That's right. And it is very interesting. I think that's a nice parallel with Mizoguchi, who planned to die, but at the last minute decided no, and had the experience of watching the flames engulf King Kakuji while he smoked a cigarette. Yeah, in the case of Mishima-san, he was called up and was made to go for a physical examination. And he had been suffering from a very bad cold, or he had a fever, he had night sweats the previous night. He was in a bad way. But I guess his good luck was that probably the physician was fairly inexperienced, and in listening to his chest, he heard something, and he thought it was something like incipient tuberculosis, something really serious. And Mishima-san, of course, knew that that wasn't it, that it was just an extremely bad chest cold. But he didn't say anything at the time. And in fact, he says in a nonfiction memoir, which I'm translating, he says that he and his father, who had accompanied him to the examination, they left the examination place and ran to the nearest railway station. With a feeling of tremendous relief. He wasn't going to be drafted. He wouldn't go to war. So there is that. I think he may have felt afterwards a certain guilt that he didn't go to war. If he'd been completely honest, he probably could have gone to war and been killed. But he, again, like Mizoguchi, at the last minute, he felt, well, perhaps I don't have to do this. But it must have... As he grew older, and as he thought about the meaning of the war and the emperor and Japan, Japanese tradition, it must have produced a real conflict within him. Yeah.
Do you know if Mishima had friends or associates that were in the war?
I think he must have.
He must have.
I must have.
I mean, everyone was affected by it.
Yeah, right. He was not, I don't think any members of his family were, but he was at Gakshuin. And he and his classmates talked about it all the time. What's kind of the use? German, of course, was the fashionable language, not English. And he was sterben. Do you think you're going to be? How do you feel when you are going to be confronted with the need to sterben, to die? And so he had that conversation with someone. But I think that person with whom we had the conversation, in fact, did die in the war.
Well, it's interesting. It's just, again, I think we've talked about sort of the man and his career somewhat. And, of course, a great interest in Japan happened after the war, the emergence of film, directors such as Ozu Yasujiro and others. This work started to slowly make its way into the Western world. And that maybe connects back to a longer history of Japonism and this fascination of Japanese aesthetics. But certainly Mishima was an iconic figure in that moment. But of course, throughout his work, though, the actual essence of it, there is these themes of, again, beauty, sacrifice, very dark and quite deep cutting questions. And of course, the image of the war and even here in Tokyo, the utter obliteration of this city from the face of the earth, for the most part, by fire, is a profound image to deal with. You know, it wasn't simply a case of bombing, but an incineration of a city that, of course, killed more people than Hiroshima in one night.
Tokyo bombings.
Tokyo fire bombings, I think March 11th it was, 1945. And so there's this imagery of this kind of the burning away of a city and what that must have been like.
And then to have, hear the emperor make a radio address that said, a quavering voice, no, we must endure the unendurable. The war has been must be brought to an end. And there are pictures of people, this ordinary Japanese, kneeling on the gravel in front of the Imperial Palace and weeping. And some people committed suicide in the sense that their life was over, their world was ending. And some very sort of innocent, pure-hearted people may have felt that they hadn't done enough for the country to win the war. Well, the very fact that the war was lost somehow was part their fault.
Yeah, well, I mean, coming to this imagery, I mean, I had a look back through the Sea of Fertility series of books, four books that perhaps would be considered his magnum opus, and very long books, which I read as a younger man, and they left a profound impact on me. And I just went back through last night and looking at the last line of Decay of the Angel, the last sentence of the Decay of the Angel, there was no other sound, the garden was empty, he had come to a place that had no memories, nothing. And I think about that sense of emptiness, and then when we, of course, look at Mishima's death by ritual suicide with the sword, there's this kind of performance and this emptiness. There's just I don't quite know how to describe it, but when I emailed you, I wrote about how I felt this physical sensation reading some of it, even some of his other writing, such as Patriotism, which deals with a similar story of ritual suicide, right. And it really physically affected me. And has that been an experience for you? Like,
well, yes, especially if you see the film, yes. Rite of Love and Death, which is based on Patriotism, in which he wrote the script, he directed it, and he starred in it as the lieutenant, Takeba. So when you realize, I mean, when you see that, it's about a half an hour, it's extremely difficult to watch. And then, of course, the knowledge that in a way it was a kind of rehearsal for what he was to do, what, 5 or 6 or 7 years later. It's very, very gripping. Although, and since I knew him, I had met him, I had coffee with him or dinner with him several times. It was
Can you tell me about
stunning
that?
For me.
Can you tell me about that, the man himself? Because for me, coming in much later and only being able to have met people who met him and only being able to follow after his words, but actually having met the man himself, what was your impression of Mishima?
Well, first, I was in awe of him because I had been reading Japanese literature in translation through high school. I was a very strange Minnesota high school student, Catholic high school, but there I was reading Mishima Tazai, Kawabata Tanizaki. And I was very much impressed by Mishima-san. And so at the age of 20, I started studying Japanese at 18 at the University of Minnesota. English Lit was my major, but my foreign language was Japanese. And I did second year intensive Japanese. Boy, was that intensive. One summer at Stanford University, So first year was freshman year at Minnesota. Second year was Stanford, intensive summer. Third year again was back in Minnesota. And at that point, it was my third year of Japanese, but I was still a sophomore. And I learned that Stanford had set up a program in Japan for intensive study of Japanese language. And I was bound and determined to go. So I applied for that. And I was lucky enough to get it. I was admitted and with a scholarship to my Japanese friends. So I asked my ryugakusei friends how much money would I need to live in Tokyo. And they said, of course, imagine what they would need to live in Tokyo as students. It was grossly inadequate. But that's what I asked for. And I got it. What you asked for, you got, if they wanted you as a student. But I soon felt that it was inadequate. And they were very kind. I went in and said, what do I know? I was guessing, but I was wrong. So they quickly upped it. I almost doubled it to allow me to live comfortably, reasonably in Japan, rather than like a miserable student. So there I was, and I met, how everything in Japan that has been good for me has happened through meeting people who know people who know people. And I met somehow a German Jewish man who had fled the Nazis, came to Japan in 1937 or 38 with almost no money at all, and he spent the war years here in Japan under the sponsorship of the Swedish embassy. He was stateless. He was a German Jew, so stateless, but the Japanese admitted him, and then the Swedish embassy had hired him to help them out with various things. So he's the only foreigner I knew who said, I spent the whole of the war in Tokyo. And we would be on the bus passing by Nijubashi, and everybody would stand up and do saikere because the emperor was there. He experienced all of that as a German Jew. So anyway, he had a friend who was very high up in Shochiku, the big
film company.
Cinema. And dramatic company. He was the secretary to the head of Shochiku. And I met him. And they said, they were 20 years old from the Midwest and learning Japanese and very enthusiastic. And they said, well, is there somebody you particularly want to meet? I said, yes, Mishima Yukio. And they came back and said, we could do that. He's coming to the Shinbashi Embujo, still exists, to watch a rehearsal of Kanjincho, famous kabuki play. Why don't you come that day? So I skipped class and went, and Mishima-san was there, and we all watched it for about an hour or so. Then I was just informally introduced to him, and we all went out and had a cup of tea or coffee or something. And so that's how I met him. And I was just full of, I was in awe of him. I mean, he was one of the writers I most admired, and here I was meeting him in a social, way. And I think I was very lucky timing. Today, so you're a foreigner, you're interested in Japan, you're learning Japanese, well, so what? But in 1964 or 5, pretty unusual. And many Japanese were very, as long as they realized that you were sincerely interested and were making an effort, they were very, very kind and cordial. And that included Mishima-san also. So I didn't have a meishi, but I gave him my address, the telephone number, and I think he gave me an meishi. Anyway, after a few weeks, he got in touch with me and said, would you like to see Kendo? I do Kendo, and I'm going to a police academy to do it, and I think it would be good for you to see this aspect of Japan. So I said, yes, certainly. So he took me, and we saw Kendo. I wasn't interested in Kendo, and I was turned off by the sort of the shouts and screams as they attack each other. I was very much a pacifist at that point in my life. But I hid that. I thanked him for showing it to me. And so that was the beginning. And I think he took me for dinner afterwards. There was a Chinese restaurant right in front of the Shinjuku Kuyakusho. I don't know if it still exists, but I remember there was the Kuyakusho, and here was this rather good Chinese restaurant that we ate at. And So that, and there, after that, there were other, a few other meetings like that to see a play or a film or attend a cultural event. And for me, the most important thing was I was invited to a buffet dinner at Mishima-san's house. I had a formal, if I looked for it, I could find it, the engraved invitation, Mr. and Mrs. Yukio, in English, Mr. and Mrs. Yukio Mishima invite Mr. Paul McCarthy, McCarthy was misspelled, of course, to a buffet dinner at such and such a time. This probably was spring or early summer of 1965. Mishima-san was, my impression of him was, in his dealings with me, he was kind, he was magnanimous, he had a good sense of humor, he laughed. Sometimes we talked about politics, and we, of course, we were at opposite. I was typical anti-war leftist student, and he was rightist and basically supported Japan's alliance with the U.S. in Vietnam. But we didn't fight. I mean, again, because I was still in awe of him. I wasn't going to, you know, blast away at him. But I did say, I just don't understand your politics.
Was he the kind of man who you would ask a question and he would respond and then throw it back at you, or was he more prone to monologue in a conversation? Like, how would you rate that side of him as a...
Not monologue, not overwhelming, but he would approach, for example, he quickly divined that I was anti-war and sort of left. And he, one thing he said to me, he said, Paul, you mustn't think of the, because I used the word right wing, he said, you mustn't think of the Japanese right wing as like the American right wing, like these Ku Klux Klaners, these, you know, obscene, fat, redneck Southerners. He did say rednecks, I remember that. He said, you mustn't think of them that way.
Akakubi? Are,
huh?
He said Akakubi, or was that?
Well, whatever the, it was, he may have used red, he may have used redneck. The English word, redneck.
Yeah.
Because he liked to speak English.
He spoke English for them or Japanese?
For the most part.
English.
For the most part, English.
I see.
He liked to speak English. And his English was pretty good. Yeah. It was certainly better than my Japanese. So, so he probably said redneck. And he, Ku Klux Klan, redneck. It's not like that. He said that there's something pure and pure-hearted and more noble about the Japanese right wing. So I just listened. Oh, really? It was that sort of thing. He would give me, forced me to look at things from a different point of view. But what struck me then even, and even more now, he was essentially making an aesthetic comparison.
Yeah.
The American right wing was overweight and redneck and vulgar, and the Japanese right wing were pure-hearted youths, young samurai. So it was aesthetic, which I think is important.
Yeah.
We didn't really argue politics. He was pulling me towards his aesthetic. And that was also the idea of Ken introducing me to Kendo so that I could see it. And he even urged me. He said, you should take up martial arts or something like that. He was barking up the wrong tree. I had no interest in that.
Pulling on that thread, I mean, this aesthetic occupation, I mean, would you say he kept up with the news of the day? Was he well-read in sort of the political side as well?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. I think he was very much interested in Japanese politics and also relations, Japan's position in the world, relations with the U.S. He was
the way people saw Japan, perhaps,
and the way people saw Japan. Mm-hmm. So he was very open and friendly with Scott Stokes, who was the London Times man in Tokyo.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there was a genuine liking, but I'm also sure that he was aware that this was a way of getting his point of view across to people outside Japan.
Yeah. No, this is fascinating. And as I mentioned before, I met someone recently who was friends with Henry Scott Stokes, and I believe Henry Scott Stokes was at the rally, the last moments of Mishima, right?
Apparently
is that
not
true? Okay.
Apparently, according to, I heard the same story, and apparently Scott Stokes said that Mishima-san urged him to come.
I see.
And but he couldn't. He tried. He couldn't get close to the Ichigaya.
Maybe the police.
Because the police, right, was impossible.
Yeah.
So we'll never know what Mishima-san would have said if he had met Scott Stokes that last time. But I suppose, again, he was a foreign friend, and he was a prominent journalist and could make Mishima-san's views known. There was none of that with me. I mean, I was still only a graduate student. But he didn't give me any hint or indication at all what he was going to do.
Yeah.
I met him a couple of times. And
do you remember when you had coffee with him? What was his coffee? Milk or black?
I really don't remember. I'm not even sure it was coffee. It may have been a drink. It may have been like at a bar and had a Mizuwadi or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, understood.
But I do remember the last time I met him.
Yes.
The last time we met, we did have this political, sort of semi-political discussion where he contrasted the right wing of the U.S. and Japan, sort of trying to draw me more sympathetic. And after that, he sent me, do I have it somewhere? He sent, the only thing he ever gave, he gave me a copy of the English translation of Taiyo Totetsu.
Oh, yes.
Sun and Steel. There it is. Very, very good. Yes, 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 yes. He sent this to me with an inscription.
Oh.
This is, he sent this to me in...
Mishima Yukio.
So.
Poru
Makashi.
Makashi. Sama.
So.
Yeah. Oh, please.
Yeah. Yeah. So this, he said this, it must have been summer of 1970.
Yeah, oh, please. Yeah.
So, but he sent me this.
Wow.
And, you know, if so I had no sense that this was going to be the last. It was the last time I met. No, it wasn't. It was the second to the last, next to the last time we met, and he sent me this, and I wrote a thank you note. And then we met by chance in maybe September, October of 1970. You know, Shinjuku, I was walking down Yasukuni-dori, moving toward it was Isetan and then Yasukuni-dori and Hanazono Jinja here. So I was moving up in this direction, and I saw Mishima coming right towards me. And I sort of bowed, and he nodded, and we chatted just for a couple of minutes. That was the last time I actually encountered him. And he went on, and I was curious. I wondered, where is he going? And he went in to a movie theater, which still exists. I can even show you where it is. He went in, and I was still curious, so I went to see, what is he going to see? Yukoku, patriotism.
Yes.
So in the fall of that year, he was going to see his own film of
by himself.
The Ritual Suicide.
Yeah.
That is a clear memory in my mind.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh. But I just thought, oh well, he's going to see a film that he made,
yeah.
And that was the last time I saw him.
Yeah.
Mishima said to me, some people really disliked him and said he was arrogant, and not to me. He was just very kind,
yeah,
extraordinarily kind, and I think it was partly because that was, I think I had that side of him that he was kind to people who were young and interested in fans of his, and expressed that in a sincere way. And then also maybe he thought this is a young man who's going to go into Japanese literature, and maybe he will eventually translate me. I don't know, but I did.
You did.
40 years on.
Did you ever talk about faith or religion with Mishima?
No, we really didn't. I've been thinking about that, but we really did not. I don't think religion was very important to him personally. I don't have a sense that he had a strong religious faith in anything. And in one of his essays, as yet untranslated, but I think it will be, he says something about, he's talking about his youth or his adolescence. He said, if things had been different, I might have become a more religious person, which means he wasn't a very religious person.
Well, this is interesting to me because I think... my impression from that is that there is an aesthetic use of religious imagery then.
Sure, sure.
And yet, perhaps he doesn't believe it. It's a performance. And again, I'm struck by Voices of the Fallen Heroes, this blood sacrifice, the imagery of this, this death for the emperor that proved to be no more than just human. This vivid imagery, profound imagery of the last seconds of a kamikaze attack,
yes,
into an aircraft carrier.
It's kind of ecstasy.
Yeah, this riveting, I was just reading it again on the train, but this riveting imagery of targeting the lifts on the center of the aircraft carrier.
Look, 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 just look.
Yeah, and and then to not even see the outcome of that, but to become one with this infinity in that moment.
At the moment of death, possibly oneness with the emperor. Yeah, but so that was really true. But I also he also had a strong intellectual interest in religion. For example, he had to go deeply into Zen in order to be able to write Kinkakuji, the Temple of the Golden Pavilion. So he gives background to Zen, the meaning of koan, and the whole issue of Zen. So there was that, and then in the tetralogy, the kind of key point, the underlying theme is the idea of reincarnation,
transmigration,
which is deeply Buddhist. And in this, in the second volume, Runaway Horses, there's a lot about Shinto and Mount Miwa in central Japan, Saigusa Shrine. So he clearly did his research. And of course, in the third volume, which for me is the least interesting, the least successful, but it's full of accounts of Yuishiki, consciousness only school, which is an extremely abstruse school in Nara Buddhism. So he worked all of that up. But does that mean that he was a devout Buddhist? I don't think so. I think he had a strong intellectual interest and, as you say, an aesthetic use of these.
Well, it's interesting. I actually read the Sea of Fertility in the wrong order. I started with the Temple of Dawn, and then I did Runaway Horse, and then I did Spring Snow, and then I did the second one, Runaway Horse, and then I finally finished with Decay of Anger.
Okay, I think you from my point of view, you started with the weakest, and then got better and better.
And certainly the story set in Thailand with the Temple of Dawn is quite interesting to me.
But it didn't really come alive for me. I think he wrote about Japan far better than he did about either India or Thailand, and he wrote about men far better than he wrote about women.
Interesting.
I didn't think that Yin Chan really came alive for me the way Kiyoaki, the first volume, or Isao in the second volume, or what was the last? Toru. In volume four, they all came alive, but Ying Cha, not really.
Yeah, it's interesting. This imagery, though, this reincarnation, trying to do it again, and yet kind of encountering the same challenges, and this is a very Buddhist thing, and I think it's challenging. You know, I've spent many years living here, and part of my own spiritual journey has been to kind of hold that in one hand, and then sort of let it go as I've dived deeper into my Christian faith and realizing that there's another way of doing things that's maybe much more, I don't know how you would describe it. It's been a discovery. And I think for a long time in my 20s, and especially when I first read Sea of Fertility and his other work, there is an appeal there. There's an energy to it.
Mm, absolutely.
It's intoxicating, this darkness. And this.
Which of the four volumes did you like the best?
I think Runaway Horses.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Runaway Horses for me was the most gripping.
I was talking about it's a common theme, the peer school, young men in this kind of environment, this kind of spirit decor.
Right. I think Isao, the protagonist of Runaway Horses, has something in common with the members of the Shield Society. Young, innocent, naive, not intellectual particularly, but passionate and
pure. Well, they had
pure
spirit. Yeah. And
the pure spirit.
And this is a theme that, again, comes up in this recent translation you've done, Voices of the Fallen Heroes, where we talk about the 226 incident and the young officers and men attempting this coup d'etat to effectively purify what they saw as an impurification of what was surrounding the emperor. So perhaps maybe you could talk a little bit about that 226 incident and maybe how that left an impression on Mishima.
He was 11 years old when it occurred, and he says that it left a big impression on him.
1936, right?
Yeah, he was at Gakshuin. He was a grade school student at Gakshuin. And he said it left a big impression on him and on other people of his generation. So when he became an adult and a writer, he sort of began to focus on it. I guess in 1960, roughly 1960, he wrote Patriotism, Yukoku, and then 1965, six, maybe, he wrote Ere no Koe. And then in between, he wrote a play, which has never been translated. So it's actually a trilogy. He has three works, a short story, Patriotism, a novella, Voices of the Fallen Heroes, and a play called Toka no Kiku, which means literally 10th day chrysanthemums. What it really means is belated chrysanthemums, chrysanthemums that came too late, because you're supposed to send chrysanthemums on the 9th day of the 9th month of the lunar year to show respect to someone. So Toka no Kiku are. So that's the problem with a literal translation. What would 10th day chrysanthemums, what does that mean? It simply means it's come too late, which is a big no-no in Japan. You've got to be timely. It's like someone's birthday. You can celebrate it early if you have to, but you shouldn't celebrate it late. Yeah. It's just not a done thing. So anyway, so it's a trilogy. That's how important it was to him, that he dealt with it at least three times. And each focuses on the Ninirokujigen, but from a different point of view, from the point of view of someone who perhaps would like to have participated in it, but couldn't because he was kept out of it by his friends who wanted him to, who didn't want to spoil his recent marriage, right? His friends kept him out of it. But had he not killed himself, the following day he would have had to join the regular army and attack his friends. Yeah. So it's two kinds of giri at war with each other, towards his friends and towards the emperor, the army. And the solution for that conflict is death.
Yeah, sort of. Even that word giri, it's, what was it, obligation or
giri ninjo? Usually, yeah. It's the Edo period, human feeling versus duty.
Duty.
But yeah. You could say it was ninjo for his friends whom he didn't want to attack. But also giddy towards the Imperial Army.
And of course, this is an event that took place. It's a handful of these soldiers who attempted this. They were successful in a sense that they did kill some of the figures, right?
They killed about three very prominent advisors of the emperor. And that's why he was so angry, because these were his trusted advisors whom he respected. Yeah. And for them to be killed or to be assassinated in that way, it must have infuriated him.
I did pick up, just reading it again though before, I did pick up a slight sense though that the tonality of that story seemed to indicate that these characters thought that these advisors were the ones leading it on the war
sure,
path.
Yes.
Was that correct? Yeah.
That's actually a fairly common theme in not only Japanese but Chinese history as well, that a virtuous emperor is being duped by the people around him.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not the emperor who's bad, it's his advisors who are bad. So what a shock for the coup plotters when they realized the emperor himself had demanded that the coup be put down, that they be imprisoned, tried, and ultimately many of them executed. That was the imperial will. That comes out in their indignant poetic utterances. How could he have done this? How could he not have understood how much we loved him and how pure-hearted we were?
And I think, again, there's the spiritual imagery, which perhaps Mishima is using aesthetically, deploying it aesthetically, but this profound imagery of the emperor and talking about this, the character says in this seance that they're doing, this divination of these spirits of these men who died in this incident. When we die, we'll go to where His Majesty the Emperor is, covered in blood. Even in death, we're loyal to our sovereign. And there's this kind of profound blood sacrifice that's spoken of. And I wanted to sort of reflect on this because, with this story of the emperor, when he did step down from that divine post, there was no Pentecost, there was no resurrection, there was no great resolution to that. It simply just kind of fizzled out. Along with that, we saw this entire country get ravaged by the war. And so this is a great sense of a spiritual emptiness there.
Yeah.
That in its own way feels very Buddhist, though, this kind of...
Well, except the problem is the word emptiness. When we use the word emptiness, we're using it in a very negative sense. When Buddhists use the word emptiness, they're using it in a very positive sense.
Okay.
Huh? Yeah. And that's why for example, the ending of the fourth volume is which you quoted from, is very significant. He goes to a temple, meets the abbess, who is none other than the beautiful young woman who appeared in the first volume, and he broaches the matter to her, and she says, "Well, what are you talking about? I don't ever." And he said, "But Kiyoaki, who? Are you sure that you're remembering things? I have no such." And then, and finally, he says, "Well, but it had to be real, otherwise." Everything, all of the transmigrations were unreal and nothing means anything. And she says, well, that's as each one thinks, as each one chooses to. So having strung the beads of the tetralogy on the string of reincarnation or transmigration, at the very end, the abbess suggests that it was all delusion, it's all a dream. And of course, that's a favorite Buddhist metaphor, that they don't say life is a dream. They say life is like a dream. Life is delusory. And so that's, I think, the point of that final thing. We're left wondering, did it really happen? What, did he interpret things properly? Was there really a connection among those three or four protagonists? Well, we're not sure. Well, what we're left with is emptiness. But emptiness, again, is such an important positive concept in Buddhism.
Well, it's profound. I mean, you mentioned Kiyoaki and this, you know, these characters of the Sea of Fertility, these young boys together in the Pierce school, again, reflecting Mishima, and Kiyoaki dies, and this search for the other character, Honda, who is kind of throughout his life, he's a very old man by the end of the book.
Yeah.
By the end of the series, he sort of encounters these various reincarnations of that character, and it takes him to all corners of the world.
Right.
Varanasi in India, to Thailand, and along the way, you know, there's this kind of great meandering. But as you say, in the end, it's all emptiness.
And there's another kind of emptiness, and this is a nihilism, that the fourth protagonist, Toru, turns out probably to be a fake, not to be real. Why? He has the marks, but he doesn't die. Everyone else has died at 20, as Mishima-san thought he would, by the way. All of them died about the age of 20, except Toru. And Toru clearly is a person of bad character. We don't like Toru. I think he represents the corruption of Japanese youth, seen by Mishima in the 60s. I can only think, if he thought about contemporary youth, what would he say about youth today? Not that I know that much about them.
Yeah.
But I think it's been a downward spiral.
Yeah.
So we doubt that he is actually an incarnation, reincarnation of the others. And he tries to kill himself, but fails. And he's simply left blind and disfigured and all helpless. So it's a very, very painful ending for the tetralogy, and we're doubting whether he could have been a real incarnation. Probably not, because he couldn't even die what he should have. And Honda, trying to understand it all, goes to this, what is it, Geshuji in Nara, and has an interview with the abbess, who is none other than, what was her name, Satoko, maybe?
Mm.
So at any rate, the aristocratic, beautiful woman. And she poses this question. So we're left the end, you know, the Japanese word for emptiness, ku.
Sky as well.
It means sky, yeah. But it also means, it's a translation of the Sanskrit word shunyata, which means emptiness. And shunyata is a word. It's a word you like the tatata, thusness. Shunyata, emptiness. It's a word. It's a kind of the ultimate reality.
Oh, that's it.
This is the ultimate reality. This is the absolute emptiness.
Well, they say ku de ari, mu de ari.
So. Yes, mu is another word for nothingness, and ku is emptiness. And yet, in certain Buddhist contexts, in important Buddhist contexts, this is absolute reality. This corresponds, for Christians, to the Godhead. not a personal god, but an impersonal godhead.
Well, that's I guess that's been really a fascinating for me personally, you know, in this context, you know, we're having a conversation and I'm interviewing you, but part of my journey through Mishima's work is it sort of lines up with a period in my life where I think I was spiritually looking for something, and where I've arrived at now as I've become a Christian, as I've learned more about this faith that in a sense underpins the Western tradition. It's been really interesting to relate that back to the context of living in Japan and having conversations with people about something like reincarnation and the great darkness and emptiness in the sense that that represents for me, and that which always was very uncomfortable, but now I feel a lot more comfortable maybe talking about it with someone because I realize that it's not the way. But it's been interesting, and I sort of feel that, you know, there's not the same light that I see with these stories. This nothingness. I don't know if there's anything you can sort of respond to.
But I don't know. I can't. It's a sorry, difficult problem.
It's hard to talk about.
But there is certainly nothingness in our sense, in the fourth volume, with our disappointment in Toru and the mess he makes of his life. But then there's the nothingness or emptiness at the very end, which the abbess expresses, and that there's nothing but silence and the sound of the cicada, right? Which reminds us of the famous haiku by, was it Basho, about the stillness, the cicada's cries penetrate the rocks. Yeah. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And that's, you see, I wish he focused on consciousness only, which is an extremely abstruse doctrine of Nara Buddhism. The other difficult doctrine, which sort of comes out, I think, at the end of the tetralogy, is called Madhyamika, which is the doctrine of the middle, in which somehow it's the dialectic of yes and no, somehow sublimated or transformed, and you're neither existence nor non-existence nor non-existence. Everything is negated, but the end is, from Buddhist point of view, ultimate truth. So it's not negative from our sense. Since I'm a Christian, I was raised as a Catholic, and then I left off the practice of it and was very interested in Buddhism, lived in Buddhist temples of a couple of different traditions briefly, not that I did intensive asceticism, but I lived in a Buddhist atmosphere. And I still love Buddha. I still love Buddhism. You see there's Amida Buddha there, and Christ on the cross there. I mean, this is they're still both active in me. It's interesting how Mishima-san never said a word about Christianity, but when he writes about, for example, Greece, his love of classical Greece, of pagan Greece and Rome, is so clear. And he hints that for him, the Christianization of Greece and Rome was a falling off.
Yes,
his longing was for the pure pantheism of Greece and Rome, which is in a way like the pantheism of Shintoism. But I don't think he was a deeply religious person. I never expressed an interest in Christianity, and I have a Buddhist nun. I lived in a Hanaria for a temple for about a year. And she, actually, her specialty was none other than Yuishi Giron. She wrote her master's degree on consciousness only. I remember her saying that she could never live in Europe. And I said, why? And she said, crosses and crucifixes everywhere. She was thinking, I think, of Italy, or all of these wayside shrines, or Italy, or Austria, or southern Germany, wherever it's Catholic. There are frequent images of crucifixion. And for her, of course, it is cruel and bloody. So the central image of the Christian faith for her is connected with bloodshed and cruelty. And of course, I tried to explain that for Christians, no, it's a symbol of love, a love that transcends pain and death. But she wasn't convinced. She was really put off by the symbol of the cross.
Well, again, it is interesting, though, this blood sacrifice, though, that Mishima does write about extensively, you know, this...
Yeah, but that's more Shinto, dying for the emperor, dying for your country, very much Mishima.
Yeah,
I don't think it plays a part in Buddhism. I don't think Buddhism has a cult of bloody sacrifice. In fact, there's no custom of, for example, even animal sacrifice in Buddhism, as there is in Hinduism. The cult of Kali, living animals are sacrificed to her because she wants blood. But that's not true in Buddhism. There's no animal sacrifice, and there's no... And I think the Buddhists, in their own way, disapprove of suicide as much as Christians do, but for a different reason. They would say it's pointless. Again, with the idea of transmigration. You're running away from something, you'll encounter it next time. It's running away, but killing yourself is not the answer. So the two traditions sometimes are saying the same things, but the hard thing for me in Christianity, in a way, not in the sense that I think it's cruel, but the emphasis upon blood from the Old Testament through the New Testament and St. Paul is very, very striking. And it's something you have to come to terms with. It says somewhere, maybe in the Old Testament, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. That's a reference to the animal sacrifice at the temple, but also, of course, the final sacrifice of Christ, in which blood no longer needs to be shed because the perfect man shed his blood for us. But still, it's blood sacrifice. But I wonder what Mishima-san would have said about that aspect of Christianity. That should have appealed to him, the idea of the shedding of blood being very crucial and important. But it's not a part of Buddhism, as far as I know.
It's almost a sense of ego there, though, that the shedding of blood, an act that we couldn't do, we couldn't perform it in the same way. You must, of course, submit yourself to that image of Christ, and you must stand before it as below it, and sort of in pass that there's, you know, a raising up of that image, and standing before God, and yet the image that we see again and again in Mishima's writing, though, is of the man himself trying to do that, and whether it's the kamikaze pilot or Mishima or these officers in the coup d'etat.
The coup d'etat who are going to, first of all, kill the wicked advisors and then kill themselves, right?
Yeah.
It's never explained why, but I imagine it's because they know that without having killed the advisors of the emperor, without the emperor's express permission, is criminal, and therefore they can pay for that by shedding their own blood. Yeah, it's full of blood.
Yeah.
Full of blood. But I don't think it comes from Buddhism. I think it comes from Mishima-san himself, and he finds echoes of it in Shinto nationalism.
Yeah. Of all your times that you spent working with Mishima's writing, of translating it, of reading it, what strikes you the most, and what have you taken away from his body of work?
Well, just the things we've been talking about. The emphasis upon death, the struggle between life and death, and the mystery of shedding one's own blood, or perhaps the blood of others, the sacrifice. All the things we've been talking about is what I take away from them. And as I am now, I wouldn't go to Mishima's fiction for some sort of ultimate truth or some sort of religious insight. I am drawn by the beauty of his language, by his learning, and by his evocation of a very rich Japanese tradition. Those are, in other words, essentially aesthetics. I'm drawn to Mishima's aesthetics, but I'm not necessarily drawn to the answer that he seems to be giving. Mm-hmm. That's why you probably were not there, because you left early. But having gone through Mishima's life and death and quotations from this work, as a kind of inspiration, when I was making notes for it, I said, but I want to end this talk after all this talk of bloodshed, I'm going to end this talk with a quotation from another great work. It's the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 30, 19th verse. Now I have set before you these two things, life and blessing, death and curses. Therefore, choose life. That was my final word. I said, therefore, choose life. And that's what I would say to Mishima-san. You should have chosen life. But maybe he did. Who knows? Who knows? And that agonizing last 10 or 15 minutes of his life, who knows what he experienced or what he said. It's like this, people, like suicides. Can't. It's medieval church thought all suicides were damned. How can you say that? Between the jumping from the height and the falling to the depths of the sea, or smashing yourself on the rocks beneath, who knows what went through the mind of the person? Who knows whether he did not repent, did not sort of see things in a different light?
And I mean, I think when you said that quote at the book launch the other day, I think that was actually the moment that I left, because I did recall you saying that quote.
You do? You yeah, heard that?
You quote. Said that. I had it written down here, and I thought that was a profound question to ask. And again, this infinity of the attack on the aircraft carrier, of the knife going into your body, it makes one think about what is life. Of course, faced with this emptiness, we must admit that there is something here as well, something real.
Well, I think Mishima was very serious about these issues, and that's why I think he looked around him at the spread of kind of cynicism and frivolity, and just as he said, Japan has one great keizai taikoku without any spiritual. I think he was right to turn away from that. But I think it's sad that he found, as a substitute, only death and blood and death and sort of self-extinction. Mm. So finally, I don't agree with him, but I admire his literature very much.
It's beautiful writing, and I think you've done a wonderful job translating that and bringing that into English in a way that there's a style to Mishima. He uses quite old Japanese.
Yes, he does. Yeah, it's about a classical style.
Style, and to bring that through into English in a way.
And very poetic. And of course, here, at key moments, they break into poetry.
Yes.
The spirits break into poetry three or four times to express their passion. So I'm glad you enjoyed it. I enjoyed doing it, and I was pretty pleased with it. I mean, I'm sure there are errors or things that could have been done differently, but I was fairly pleased with it. So one thing I will say is, after Mishima-san died, I went to my German Jewish friend, Eric, and said, you know, I think I should write my dissertation on Mishima. I think I've done enough on Tanizaki. I've done my MA on Tanizaki. He said, no, it's much too early, Paul. Don't do that. So I said, okay, I'll wait. And I waited 40 years. I spent 40 years translating Tanizaki, whom I greatly respect. But now, finally, in my last five or however many years I have left, 5, 10 years, I'll spend it translating Mishima.
That's profound, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
The final thing then is, what is next for you? I mean, you've alluded to some other work.
Yes, I am trying to put together an anthology of Mishima-san's untranslated nonfiction. He wrote memoirs, he wrote travel pieces, for example, Greece, for example, Paris, which he loathed. literary commentary, mostly on other Japanese writers. He loved Mori Ogai.
Oh, yes.
And he recognized the greatness of Tanizaki, but also felt that Tanizaki was a somewhat misunderstood writer. Remember, he wrote in his essay, which I have translated, which I hope will come out. He says, in Japanese, he says, Tanizaki wa futsu no imi de no onnazuki dewa nakatta. But he wasn't really a lover of women. So the next thing is, we've looked at 10 or 12 translators, all of whom were very skilled, very good, and try to put together an anthology of maybe 300, 350 pages of Mishima-san's untranslated memoirs, travel pieces, essays on literature, and also some lighter pieces, some comical pieces. He wrote a variety of things, which he then collected under the title Fudotoku Kyoiku Koza, Courses in Immoral Education.
You know, just finally, I think you'll appreciate this, and thank you so much for that. That probably one of my favorite short stories of his is one called Raisin Bread. I think
you might I don't know.
It's from.
Is it translated into English?
Yeah, it's in English, and it's in Acts of Worship as the compilation of stories.
Yes, I know that. So that contains Kumano.
Budo no Pan.
Budo no Pan.
I think it's called, and that was like. Just a really youthful, fun-loving short story on these kids, you know, kind of teenagers doing teenage things. There's a levity to it that I really like.
I remember that. I'm sure I've got it somewhere.
Yeah.
The volume, yeah. Acts of Worship, translated by John Bester, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't it John Bester?
I'm not sure who translated it, but so... Within that, there's some beauty, and I look forward to maybe reading a little bit more of his nonfiction, perhaps, as you finish that. But, Paul, thank you so much for sharing your experience. Again, this is Voices of the Fallen Heroes and Other Stories,
yes.
And you've translated three stories, actually, in this anthology.
Yes, they're all very different.
Yes, I enjoyed all three of them, actually. Very, as you say, very different.
The good news is that I heard from the publisher that they are going to be publishing a paperback edition in January of next year.
Excellent.
So it's selling fairly well. Yeah. I would have thought this was a paperback edition, but I guess it isn't. This is their equivalent of a hardback, semi-hardback.
Yeah.
But they are going to put out another edition.
Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I enjoyed this.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.